science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
Well, welcome aboard. And a very special guest coming up on the show today, a little bit later, Julie Payette. Most of you, of course, are familiar with Julie for two reasons. She's a former astronaut, having flown twice on the space shuttle. And, of course, she was also our former governor general, and she headed the Montreal Science Center. So she's not only an astronaut, but a scientist as well. And we're going to chat with Julie about the eclipse that is coming up. And whenever I get a chance to speak with her, I always like to ply her for information about spaceflight. It's one of my passions. And so I'm going to ask her about what it felt like when she first went into space and what it was like when it was up there. And also, we'll take a look at the possibility of going back to the moon again and for a trip to Mars. So that's coming up after our first break. But I want to tell you an interesting little story, maybe. For the first time ever, I ate ramen noodles. And that was on a cruise ship a couple of weeks ago when I was on a cruise. And they had this offering, and I had never had that before. And I thought that it would be interesting. And I thought now I would take a look a little bit at the history of this, because I think that is also fascinating. So anyway, you know, at the turn of the millennium, a Japanese poll asked about the best Japanese invention of the previous century. You know what the answer was? Instant noodles. Japan, as well as China, have a long history of eating noodles, mostly wheat, although rice noodles are also popular. And then in 1958, along came Mofuku Ando with an idea. If noodles were hot air dried or quickly fried after they were steamed, they would last a long time and could be readily cooked by dumping into boiling water. The instant noodles could be mixed with various flavor additives to yield a quick soup. Ramen noodles, using the Japanese term, are high in salt, and some can contain a significant amount of fat. But the noodles are not deadly. Why should that idea even come up? Because of headlines that routinely float around the web about, quote, what happens in your stomach when you consume packaged ramen noodles with a deadly preservative. Well, this bit of nonsense refers to a video that's been making the rounds about an experiment carried out by gastroenterologist Dr. Braden Kuo at the Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Kuo had a subject swallow a pill camera capable of transmitting images from inside the gut. And you probably heard about this camera. It was an Israeli invention, and it is really a neat device. It can diagnose all kinds of gastrointestinal problems. Anyway, he found that processed noodles churned around in the stomach longer than fresh noodles before breaking down. This doesn't have much significance, since nutrient absorption takes place in the small intestine after food has been broken down in the stomach. But how long that breakdown takes is really not important. Why the processed noodles take longer to disintegrate in the stomach can have many reasons. The moisture and fat content of the noodles can be quite different. The gluten content, which depends on the kind of flour used and the amount of kneading, makes a difference, as does the shape of the noodles. But one thing that will not have an effect is the trace amount of a preservative known as tertiary butyl hydroquinone, or TBHQ, that may be present in some instant noodles. Yet, this is the ingredient that generated the nonsensical information that is being spread around the web. The claim is that it is the preservative that prevents the noodles from being broken down, and the failure of the noodles to be broken down as quickly as fresh noodles represents some kind of danger to health. Both of these claims are absurd. The preservative, which in fact is not commonly used in noodles, prevents fat from going rancid, which is a process that can indeed produce toxins. The amount of TBHQ used is trivial, 0.02% by weight of the fat content of the food. That translates to a few milligrams, a tiny fraction of the amount that can cause any harm in an animal. Of course, the scary emails do not take amounts into account. Rather, they blather on about nausea, diarrhea, and ringing ears, which may happen at huge doses of TBHQ that cannot be attained from food. And most assuredly, TBHQ has nothing to do with the rate at which noodles decompose in the stomach. This is not an argument for eating processed ramen noodles, which are not great, particularly because of the salt content, but it is a plea for rational thinking and the investigation of claims made by internet bloggers who do not know what they are talking about. Dr. Kuo himself was not troubled by his findings and says that he eats processed noodles himself. So, how about my experience with the ramen noodles? I be honest with you, I don't think it was one of the highlights of my gustatory life. I actually found them quite salty. And that's one thing, of course, that we talk about a great deal these days is the salt content, the sodium content of foods. And this is really the curse of many of the processed foods that we consume. They are so high in salt. Our daily intake of sodium at most should be about 2,300 milligrams, although I think that that is high. I think we should aim for about 1,500 milligrams. And I can tell you that one of these cups of ramen soup that you can buy and you just pour boiling water into it, it can have 1,000 milligrams of sodium, so almost your daily requirement. But anyway, I thought it would be interesting to take a look at, you know, some of the history here of the ramen noodles. I don't say that I would never eat it again, but it's not exactly, you know, my kind of taste. Anyway, that's what happened on my cruise. I had my first taste ever of ramen noodles. Well, coming up, as I said, is a conversation with Julie Payette, a former astronaut, former Canadian Governor General, also a pilot, and a scientist at heart. We're going to talk about the eclipse, and we're also going to talk about Julie's first venture into space. So stay tuned for that. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll check traffic and be right back.
Life's everyday mysteries solved. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
As I mentioned, my guest is Julie Payette, and she doesn't need much of an introduction. Of course, an astronaut, our former governor general, former head of the Montreal Science Center, and it's always a great pleasure, Julie, to speak with you, and especially now because of this upcoming major event, the eclipse, that has captured people's imagination. And I know that you're very interested in this, as anyone who's interested in what is going on up there in the sky is. So tell me what, first of all, I think maybe describe to people exactly what it is that is happening, because a lot of people don't really know. They don't know whether it's the Earth between the Sun and the Moon between the Sun and the Earth, or whatever. So what is this eclipse that is going to happen?
Hello, Dr. Joe. Thank you for having me. So this big event is going to happen on the 8th of April next month in the middle of the afternoon. And it is a total solar eclipse in our region. This is a very rare phenomenon. The moon, as we all know, rotates around the Earth and the Earth, as we all know, rotates around the sun. But there are times when all three align, and when the moon passes in between the sun and the Earth, then it casts a shadow on the Earth. And that shadow is actually quite small, because the moon is really a lot smaller than the Earth. But that shadow, if you are on Earth in that shadow completely, you will see the sun disappear for a few minutes while you're on the ground. It will go from day to night and then back to day a few minutes later. Of course, all of this is possible if there's no cloud cover, but the eclipse is going to happen no matter what. And because this alignment is rare, things have to be perfectly aligned, and we have to be at the right place on Earth to see it, it doesn't happen very often. In Montreal, we are going to have a total zone, but that zone will not happen again until 2106. So that's in more than 80 years from now. I won't be there. So I will try not to miss this total solar eclipse in our region.
I remember when I was in elementary school, which was in the late 1950s, 70s. Was there not such an eclipse? When is the last time we had it in Montreal?
Oh, I think it's been years. We've had several partial eclipses in the region. I too remember being in elementary school in the 70s, 71, and there was a partial solar eclipse. And I remember that I had been told that this was extremely dangerous and that I should not look up at the sun under any circumstance. So I remember being quite afraid of this because of what we had been told.
Yeah, I remember that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember. I think we were told to go under our desk in the classroom.
Yes, and that is a myth. That is completely untrue. When the sun is shining out there, people go about their activities and they do all kinds of things outside without any real worries. Of course, if you bathe in the sun for too long without sunscreen, then you might get a sunburn. But otherwise, we're never afraid of the sun. But at the same time, we never look up at the sun. We never look up because it hurts our eyes. When there's an eclipse, we should do the exact same thing. We should go about our activities, but don't look up at the sun. If you'd like to look up at the sun, whether it is the sun shining normally or the sun shining with an eclipse, you should use special solar glasses to do that so that you don't hurt your eyes.
Now, when there's the moment of totality, right?
Yes.
I mean, at that point, you're not seeing the sun. So is there any harm in looking up then at the exact moment of totality?
That is exactly right. We don't have to use special glasses during the totality. Yeah. The problem is the totality is very short. If I speak about the Montreal region, the full eclipse will take about 2.5 hours from the moment the moon starts covering the sun little by little. That's while the moon is not covering it up completely, we call it a partial eclipse. And then at what point in time, from our point of view in Montreal downtown, for example, the moon will cover the sun completely. That's when we call it the total. That period is very small. In Montreal, it won't last more than about 1.5 minutes. So 90 seconds of totality. So by the time the moon covers the sun, we will go from day to night. If there's no cloud cover, we even are probably going to be able to see stars, but only for 1.5 minutes. And then the moon will continue its motion and the sun will start uncovering. As soon as the sun starts uncovering, we should put the glasses if you'd like to watch the eclipse.
You know, one of the most amazing things for me about all of this is how this can be predicted virtually to the second, right? And I mean, that goes historically back, you know, a lot of years, right? I mean, I guess Newton probably could have predicted it, no?
Certainly, because the motion of the moon has been studied for a long time, and it's quite well understood. We can calculate where it is in the sky at any time because it's orbiting around. We understand its orbit, and we know how long it takes for going around the Earth once. It's about 27 days and a third of a day. So because of that, then people were able to calculate for a while. They could also predict when the alignment would happen. There are seasons in which this alignment is better than others. And we call it the eclipse season. But can you imagine, Joe, how powerful those who could predict an eclipse in the old times were in the psyche of the society they were in? Because the sun would go away. And that must have been a very terrifying phenomenon when it happened, when people did not understand what it was. But if someone understood that, and we have for a long time, that the sun would disappear behind the moon and then reappear a few minutes later, that power of prediction must have been very, very beneficial for the person who had it.
Oh, for sure. I would guess they could have been looked on as, you know, virtually a god, right, with supernatural powers to be able to do this, especially if they said that they were going to make the sun disappear at the appropriate time. I mean, we've come a long way since then scientifically, but the conspiracy theorists are still out there. And I mean, if you go on the internet these days, there are all kinds of nonsense about the eclipse and about what it can do to people. It can make people sick, etc. So I wanted to get into that a little bit and get your view on that. But we got to take a bit of a break here to check on what is happening out there in the world with news. And we'll be right back with Julie Payette, former astronaut, former governor general, and great scientist. So we'll talk about the eclipse a bit more. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show.
It's all about chemistry. Science you can use. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800. It's all about chemistry.
We're back with Julie Payette, former astronaut, former pilot, or maybe current pilot. You still pilot plane?
Yes, I do.
also former head of our science center here. And so Julie is just the right person to speak with when we're talking about the eclipse. And we were mentioning before, all of the nonsense that is out there on the internet, of course, about everything, but now about the eclipse and people saying that it's going to cause all kinds of illness in people. Well, you know, what drives this kind of nonsense?
I think in the past there was incomprehension or ignorance, worries about what this was and what it meant. And I think human beings, they don't like not knowing. That creates a vacuum, not knowing, and they absolutely have to find an explanation. Nowadays, though, with the social media and the capacity of people to start with a controversy and then let it blossom, I think is another human trait, the need for attention.
Yeah, I mean, there certainly are going to be some effects, certainly on animals, right? I mean, all the stories about roosters starting to crow, right, during an eclipse. I mean, is that something that is really has been shown scientifically that happens?
I do not know about roosters. This will be my first total solar eclipse, but what I do know is that indeed, there is a change in luminosity that lasts a few hours, a slight change in luminosity. But then when the total happens, then there is a drastic change in and where it goes from day to night to day. And many animals use that luminosity to trigger some of their behavior. Will the crickets start cricketing, or will a rooster start crowing? It's possible, but it lasts the totality so such a small period of time, a minute and a half at most, three minutes and some. That's not going to change that much. But will it confuse some animals? It's highly possible. Will it also scare some humans? I think so too. Interestingly, animals do behave in their environment because that's what they've evolved to do. But on my second space flight, we launched in Central Florida in the middle of the afternoon. And even though everything is very clean around the space shuttle before a launch to space, it turns out that there were a few mosquitoes that made it inside the spacecraft while we were going in and then ended up in space with us. And I can tell you they were behaving very weirdly because it's not the environment they were used to. They were like turning and spinning around like crazy because they needed gravity and there was none anymore.
Well, that's a nice segue into what, you know, I'm really most interested in is your space travel experiences and where the future of this space program lies. And it's certainly very different from the space shuttle era, right? Because now you've got Elon Musk getting into the game. You have other private venturers sort of cooperating with NASA. Where do you think this is heading? I mean,
It's heading in the right direction in the sense that now we've been able to go to space for a little bit more than 50 years. And we are now, to some extent, able to open up the access to low Earth orbit, so the orbit close to us, very, very close to us, to more people and more diverse types of people and to commercial companies. This is where we are. This is brand new that people can buy a ticket to do a suborbital flight, which is just up in the sky to space and then straight back down to Earth, or to buy a very expensive ticket to go in orbit of the Earth. But this is just opening this era where more people will be able to go to space and contemplate the magnificent view of our planet at their feet. This is going to go slowly. It's still a very risky business to fly outside the atmosphere of the Earth for the good reason that we have to fight gravity to get there. And we need powerful rockets, and powerful rockets are machines, and machines can fail. So it is very risky still to go on orbit of the Earth, but it's an extraordinary adventure. And I, for one, think it's a very good idea that more people get to see our precious planet from above. When you're in a spacecraft, it strikes you not only the beauty, but how important this planet is, because it is right now the only place where we can live. So we need to take care of it.
Would you have any concerns about going on one of Musk's rockets?
At the moment, SpaceX, which is the company that he has founded, is done several launches, both as cargo resupply ship to the International Space Station, bringing up astronauts to the International Space Station. They even have some many commercial satellite launch. I saw one at Cape Canaveral just last week. They're doing very well. They're moving very, very fast. If people have been following the test that they're doing on this massive rocket called Starship, which they hope to eventually bring people to the moon and back in pretty much one go, they're moving very fast. Personally, I know that machines are machines, and they don't always exactly behave the way they want. But at the moment, they're doing extraordinarily well, and no, I would not have any qualms in boarding a SpaceX rocket.
On your first space shuttle flight, at the moment of ignition, were you nervous?
Not so bad. And I know my colleagues are very similar. And the reason is because we are so well trained and we have the knowledge of what's going on. We know where we are, we know where we're going and what we're going to do. We've worked years to get there. I often say that you're nervous when you're not so sure what's going to happen, or you're not so sure of, and you don't know, you know, if it's new. But in this particular case, you kind of know what's going on, and therefore you're much less nervous. And because you have to be strapped in to the space shuttle 2 hours before launch, and you're on your back in a spacesuit, and it's kind of warm, and there's this fan circulating air behind your ears that does moom, 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 moom like that, it's actually quite quiet in there. And many of us, me included, well, take a nap while waiting for the countdown to get closer to T equals zero.
So you were really relaxed. What was the shaking? Was the shaking at the moment of launch more or less than you thought it would be?
Oh, that's different. So you take a nap when you're not solicited by launch control system, or you don't have to do anything. But at T-minus 9 minutes and counting, when we resume the countdown for the final time, and we're really now about to launch, everybody is awake and alert. And as soon as we go down to T equals zero, as soon as the rocket light, the solid rocket.
Julie, hold that thought. Hold that thought, because our tea has just expired for this segment. We've got to take a break, check traffic, and we'll be back with you launching into orbit. Guest is Julie Payette. You're listening to the Dr. Joe Show. We'll be back right after we check traffic.
Your source when you need answers. The Dr. Joe Show on CJAD 800.
We're back with Julie Payette, former astronaut, and we were just about to launch her into space. So you were saying that you were kind of relaxed until the moment of launch when you really started to pay attention. So how was the rumbling and the shaking at that time?
Well, since it was my first time on my first flight, I didn't know what to expect in terms of shaking. You train for almost everything at NASA, but you can't exactly train for a rocket launch. So when the T equals zero and main engines of the space shuttle have already been roaming for 6 seconds and then the solid rocket booster lit, then you know you're going somewhere, because you just like start moving. And the shaking for the first 2 minutes and a half is quite impressive. It's quite a ride, and it's a good thing that we have a 5-point seatbelt that keeps us on our seat, because it's shaking a lot. But as soon as the solid rocket boosters, there are the two white rockets of the space shuttle, they detach about 2.5 minutes into flight. And once they detach, then we continue our journey to space on the three engines of the space shuttle, and that part then becomes a lot smoother. But it is also when we're outside the atmosphere and we can start really accelerating. We get pinned down into our seat for another five minutes, and we shut down our engines 8.5 minutes later when we reach orbit. So very shaky for the first 2.5 minutes, very smooth but crushing acceleration for the next 5 minutes, and 8.5 minutes later, you do something that you cannot train on the ground, as you transition from acceleration, which we go to 3G, so three times the force of gravity, pinned down into our seat, to zero gravity in 1/4 of a second.
And then when you release your seatbelt for the first time, you just float up out of your seat?
Yes, and actually when we shut down our engine and we go from 3Gs to zero gravity, weightlessness. We can see things starting to float in the cabin immediately. You can feel that you're no longer pinned down in your seat. And once you undo your seatbelt, then yes, you don't stay in your seat, you start floating.
What was the first thing you did as soon as you floated?
We are quite amazed to have reached in space. However, we have to reconfigure the space shuttle from the rocket ship we just rode to space to a spacecraft that will be our house for the length of the mission, 2 weeks. And that conversion is very important. Everybody has several roles to do. We have to open up the cargo bay doors. We use that to cool down our equipment, deploy our antennas, reconfigure our computers, set up the tent, take off our flight suits. So it's quite busy. But I was in charge of opening up the cargo bay doors. Very important. It's something you have to do very quickly after reaching orbit. And when because we were flying upside down with the cargo bay facing the Earth, when I opened up the first door, then I got my first big glimpse of planet Earth, the blues and the whites and the oceans and the continents. It was extraordinary. But then again, I had to open, to continue the procedure to open the second door. And so you kind of like have a half a second where you say, oh my God, this is extraordinary. And then you go back to work.
Well, today there's a lot of talk about eventually going to Mars. What do you think? How realistic is that in the near future?
It will happen. There will be a time when humans will go to Mars, because that's our job, human beings that explore. It's to push the frontier of wherever the known world is. We've done that since we've existed on this Earth. It's not quite in the near future because it's complicated. Mars is another planet, and it's not on the same orbit as the Earth, unlike the Moon. So what will happen in the near future is we're going back to the Moon. And next year, Artemis 2 is bringing 4 astronauts, including our Canadian Jeremy Hansen, on board. And we're going back to the Moon for the first time in more than 50 years, with the idea that in the coming years, we will be able to land on the Moon again. Our interest is to land at the South Pole of the Moon, because there is ice in craters that never see the sun. So this ice could be used as a resource because it contains oxygen and hydrogen. So that would be the reason why we want to land on the South Pole. So that we will see in the next few years. Once we know how to do this safely and well, then perhaps the very complicated journey to bring humans to Mars will happen. I'm confident, though, Joe, that the first human that will walk on Mars is probably born today, but probably a young child.
Yeah, well, it's going to be quite a challenge, not in terms of the physics. I mean, I think, you know, that's well worked out. Obviously, we can go to Mars, that hasn't been demonstrated very clearly with the robot spacecrafts. But there's all the other concerns. It's going to be at least 2 years right there and back. So you've got the social problems of people, you know, confined in a small space for so long, and food problem, possible radiation issues cosmic radiation issues that have to be solved. It's fascinating, but very challenging.
Right. And all the logistics as well. I mean, we need to breathe. We need to eat. I need to clean things. I'm working on a research project, which might interest you, particularly with NASA right now, where we're looking at ways of doing laundry without water, or with little water, and without toxic solvent like we do in dry cleaning today. because we will need, if we go explore for long, long periods of time, a way of cleaning spacesuit and cleaning underwear to some extent.
Well, yeah, like I said, there are a lot of challenges. But Julie, I mean, it was great chatting with you. Unfortunately, there's never enough time. I mean, the time just flies faster than the rockets fly, right? And I mean, thanks for the talk about the eclipse and for your personal experiences on the space shuttle and for a glimpse into the future. It certainly is a great pleasure chatting with you. And we'll do it again sometime in the future because you're still doing very interesting things.
Indeed.
So thanks a lot.
Thank you, Dr. Joe. If I may say, for the people in the Montreal region, they can go to the Montreal Science Center in the Old Port. There's an activity there on the 8th of April. Also at Parc Jean Drapeau, where they will be handing out solar glasses. Hopefully the weather will be cooperating, but people should go and see this incredible phenomenon if they can. It's the 8th of April. The eclipse will start really slowly at about 2:30 in the afternoon and peak totality at 15:26.
Great. We'll be looking forward to it. So thanks again, Julie, for being with us. You've been listening to Dr. Joe Show. We'll be back with you same time, same station next week. Until then, I hope all the chemistry in your life comes out just right.